Can you check my phone, please?
I'm sorry.
Say something.
Can you hear me back there?
Is that okay, my phone? Okay. Our last speaker. I'm delighted to introduce our last speaker because I'm told that he is going to show me how we talk about the tree without squeezing oranges, and I have to say that I don't care about the beauty. That's not my thing. I'm not worried that we're leaving orange husks everywhere, but we'll deal with that later on. That we're going to see a demonstration of how consilience can inform literary studies. So this is Professor Joseph Carroll from the University of Missouri, and he's, I guess, finishing now a book on this with the same title.
It is finished.
Yes,
wonderful. Okay. I'm going to take an opportunity just to pick up a few of the main points that other people have raised along the way. First, starting with the question about forming hypotheses. Yes, you know, that's always a problem, an issue. Requires ingenuity and creativity. But take any casebook of on a given text, a casebook on Hamlet, and then have five or six representative essays from schools, from Marxism and psychoanalysis and deconstruction and feminism. And each one of those interpretive essays posits a whole series of hypotheses, interpretive hypotheses based on large-scale theories. And they can all be tested. And along with testing those hypotheses, you can test every aspect of a literary situation. You can test hypotheses about reader response, about the content, the relation of content, the elements of content, the relation of content to form. The impact on an audience, all of that can be tested. And I'm going to give you some examples, some very specific examples later on of things that can be tested. Once you establish a hypothesis that the literary text is a representation of shared experiences in the world designed by an author to have a definite impact on a reader, you've got a whole array there of propositions that can be elaborated in specific ways that can be quantified and can be tested. One point, John quoted the statement that the profession's dying. I don't think there's any danger at all of the profession dying, that is the subject matter. The subject matter is rich, as John said, interesting, wide open for explanation. Literary efforts up to this point have not merely consisted in curatorial transmission, they've consisted in efforts of explanation. Every interpretation is an effort of explanation that has appealed to large-scale causal principles. And what we need now is more explanation, better explanation than we've ever had before. We've had many strong efforts of explanation based on incomplete and inadequate theories. What we need is to, in order to reclaim or to claim a legitimate place in the university are explanations that have some kind of cogency. Cogency for our colleagues, cogency for the public at large, cogency for scientists. Explanation has a unitary characteristic. It is more or less plausible. It has greater or less empirical validity. It has more or less integration with the consilient, the larger body of knowledge that's available. We need better explanation, and we can get it. It's simply waiting there for us to take it, and a few of us have begun to make the effort to take it. I just recently wrote an article for a journal. It was a target article, an overview of the field, and had about 35 people responding to it. And one of the main complaints that the most negative responders had was they said, this is another grand theory. This is a theory that aims to explain everything, you know, a true theory of everything, sort of a mocking, dismissive way of approaching it. There's the same kind of phrases that are used for Marxism and psychoanalysis. And I took that head on. I think that's an absolutely true charge. This is a grand theory of everything. And legitimately so. It's a grand theory of everything because it's rooted in a scientifically valid idea that human beings are biological organisms that have evolved and have adapted, and that literature is a product of the adapted mind. It's designed, geared for having an impact on other minds that have evolved and adapted for all kinds of very specific purposes and have very specific effects within any given culture. So, yeah, it's a grand theory. And There's always a risk. You say, well, there have been all these theories that have been wrong. There's been structuralism and psychoanalysis and Marxism and Freudian archetypalism. Am I going to take the risk of coming up with just another grand theory? We don't have any choice. We always have to have some kind of explanatory mechanism. We take the best that's available, and we just happen to be lucky at the present time that the theory that we have available to us is a theory that's solidly established. It's not the idea of evolution by means of natural selection is a theory only in the loosest and vaguest sense. It is a fact. It's a reality. We all know it. It's confirmed in dozens of disciplines, interlocking, interacting, reciprocally confirming disciplines all across the board, in biology and ethology and neuroscience and personality theory and sex research and developmental psychology. It's there. It's available. And all of it is relevant to literary study. We need better explanation, more explanation. We have access to it. One of the questions that came up early was, show us what to do. I wrote Evolution Literary Theory, was published in 1995, and the one criticism I got that really had an impact on me, that I felt the force of, was a criticism by somebody in the Journal of Victorian Studies who said, well, you know, everything he says about post-structuralism and post-modernism might be true. I mean, it hurts. It has a certain kind of force. But he's so preoccupied with bashing the absurdities of postmodern theory and the limitations of traditional literary study. Why don't you put more effort into showing us how we can actually go out and integrate this knowledge, how we can absorb psychology and anthropology and assimilate it in a way that makes it part of the best that's been thought and said in literary study, that can take what's legitimate or valid or adequate in traditional literary study and even in postmodern study and Marxism and psychoanalysis and integrate it. So I said, okay, that's fair. Let's do that. That's actually what I've been trying to do for the past 15 years or so, is to take that challenge seriously and to see what I could do with it. And this particular study is simply the latest phase in that ongoing effort to do that. There are four authors here. John Johnson and Dan Kruger are both psychologists. This was a statistical study, and we wanted to make sure that we had people who could help us out. We're both amateurs with statistics. We know just enough to get into trouble, and we wanted them to help us get out of trouble. And so what we did, we put my field is the Victorian novel, and so just, you've got to start somewhere, you know. You have to pick a subject. And it took me a while to settle down. I've written interpretive essays along the way, but it took me a while to settle down and pick a subject and say, I'm going to pitch my tent here, because any given subject is so narrow. And what we're trying to do is actually to create a revolution, to restructure the whole discipline, to form a new paradigm. And as soon as you pick a particular subject, you're localizing yourself within a particular community, people who are interested in the 19th century novel. Fortunately, almost everybody's interested in the 19th century novel. I mean, everybody at one point or another has read Jane Austen or Jane Eyre or something. So we put a questionnaire on the web, put 2,000 characters from a couple of hundred British novels, and sent out hundreds and hundreds of emails to English professors all over the world. I looked up every English department on the web and checked all the people who teach the Victorian novel and said, come to our website and fill out some questionnaires. Pick a character, any character, and answer questions about the motives and the personality of that character, about the criteria through which that character selects mates, and tell us also about your emotional responses to that character. And all quantitative, you know, give us a scale. On a scale of 1 to 5, how do you feel about this character? Does it make you angry? 1 to 5. Does it make you sad? 1 to 5. Is this character extroverted or introverted? 1 to 5. So we got about 1,500 responses. We also hit a lot of listservs. And It sounded like a sort of a kinky, marginal thing to do. And that, you know, anything that sounds odd appeals to people in literature. You know, they're queer for the peculiar. You know, for the unique and the individual. And the, so this seemed just flaky enough. And we didn't tell them right out. We didn't say we're all, you know, raving sociobiologists. And it's going to come as a desperate shock. You know, I thanked them all in the conclusion to the book. Says, you know, thank you all of those of you who came to our website and participated. I'm sure a lot of them are going to be wishing they hadn't. But you know, we make good use of what their response is. We put up an extra website, a separate website for the mayor of Casterbridge, because we wanted to make sure, we didn't know what kind of response we were going to get, and we wanted to make sure that we got enough responses on one novel to be able to give a kind of complete critique of one novel. As it turned out, we got so many on Jane Austen that we titled the book after her and had a whole chapter on her. But we've got 441 individual characters profiled and graphed. Some of the most popular characters got many, many coatings. Elizabeth Bennet from Pride and Prejudice got 82 coatings. Jane Eyre came in a close second. So once you've got 80 coatings, 84 protocols completed on a single character, you've got a very solid, you know, fix on that character. You can say what the range of variants for that character might be. Here's the research design. We started with the assumption that the author has some kind of preemptive power in determining what characters are, what they're like. Emma, Tom Jones, David Copperfield, the author tells you, you know, the sex and the age and gives you information about the attractiveness. Almost certainly it's going to tell you something about the personality of the character and the motives of the character, the criteria by which the character selects mates. So we had our readers go in and code for all those things. And we also asked for the responses of the readers, the emotional responses. And we were, again, a working assumption is that the readers are stipulating those characteristics. The authors have identified them. The readers recognize them, and the readers are reacting emotionally to it. Built into this, there's a model of literature as a simulation of an emotionally evaluative, responsive social situation. We're taking literature as a simulated emotional social experience. And along with asking for the emotional responses, we ask these two questions. Do you want the character to succeed? And is the character's success a main feature of the story? And we expected that those would correlate with the next box. We ask the readers to assign the character to a role, either as a protagonist, an antagonist, or a minor character. And if you want the character to succeed, we expected that to correlate with the character being a protagonist. And if you think the character's success in achieving goals is a main feature of the story, we expected that to correlate with the character being a major character, either a protagonist or an antagonist, and not a minor character. Once you've got the responses of the readers and the role assignment, what you've really got is a set of polarized evaluative responses of desirable and undesirable traits in a character. And that constitutes an ethos, a set of values and attitudes and standards. And any given novel has an ethos. You can extract a thematic understanding of the value structure built into that novel. The ethos of an individual novel is part of a whole larger pool, call it a population, of novels in a given culture. And that whole pool, again, a working hypothesis for us, is an approximation of the ethos of that culture as a whole. The novels feed off of that culture and feed into that culture, and consequently they feed back into the whole set of attitudes that inform the stances and attitudes of an author when the author makes up characters. So what you've got here actually is a feedback loop. Why did we do this? Why did we set up this questionnaire on the web and ask people to come and fill out protocols? We had four reasons. The first, we wanted to demonstrate that major components of literary meaning can be reduced to the elements of human nature. We are reductionists. We are unregenerate and unrepentant reductionists. We believe that at the present time, and it has only very recently been the case, science, social science, is able actually to give us a good, usable, working model of human nature. And that working model of human nature can provide an analytic framework for understanding the representation of characters, the responses of readers, And the implication of that whole cycle of representation and response for the way novels work in a given social environment. And one of the most common beliefs in literary study, both traditional literary study, old-fashioned humanistic literary study, and postmodern literary study, is that meaning is somehow infinitely complex. It's part of this whole mind-body dualism that Ted was talking about. That science can deal with things that can be reduced to their elements, and that the causal relationships among those elements can be understood, but that the humanities deal with stuff, with geist, that is somehow infinitely mysterious and vague and diffusive and vaporous, and that it can never be reduced adequately to a few elements that can be genuinely understood. We think that's not true, and we set out to try to demonstrate that it's not true. We wanted, for the second reason we did this, we wanted to test empirically the hypothesis that agonistic structure reflects the evolved dynamics of coalitional psychology. That's a very specific hypothesis. It's the largest scale hypothesis that gives us a rationale for testing explicitly for agonistic structure. Agonistic structure is our chief topic, our chief theme in this study. And rather than just saying, well, we want to see what agonistic structure is like or what it does, we want to see coalitional psychology?
Agonistic structure.
Well, just the relationships between protagonist and antagonist, the kind of structure that emerges from all the characteristics of protagonist and antagonist and the responses of readers to them. It's one of the most common things in literary study. I mean, everybody assumes it. You know, it's like the weather. You know, everybody talks about it. They just mention protagonist and antagonist casually. But there's actually, surprisingly, almost no theory about it. And there's essentially no empirical investigation into it. So we wanted to test it, and we wanted to lodge it within one of the fundamental features of human social interaction, which is coalitional psychology. Third reason, we wanted to bring empirical evidence to bear on the theoretical controversy over the adaptive function of literature. In this article that I wrote, in the responses to the article I just wrote, more than half of the respondents focused almost exclusively on the issue of the adaptive function of literature, because they all intuitively understand that if we're ever going to get a real handle on the meaning and significance of literature, from a biological perspective, we're going to have to come to some kind of really good, solid understanding about whether literature is adaptive, how it's adaptive, if it is adaptive, what kind of functions it serves. This is the hot issue. This is the big theory. If you're interested in theory and you don't mind not having a job, but you want to get in on sort of the vanguard of what's happening, what's really happening, what's seriously conceptually happening. In literary study, this is where it's at. This is the issue. And the fourth reason, we want to generate empirical knowledge and begin a process of cumulative knowledge acquisition in literary study. I was animated, most powerfully by reason number one. That's what I had most at heart. When I first started in literary study, evolutionary literary study in the early 90s, we didn't have a model of human nature. What we had were lists, and we had Donald Brown's Human Universals. It's a wonderful book, one of my favorite books, and it's full of all kinds of interesting facts about the peculiarities of human nature that are shared in all known cultures and that constitute the universal people. But they're just lists. Steven Pinker lists them at the end of The Blank Slate. He gives a list of Donald Brown's. And Tuvian Cosmides and Barco, the adapted mind, cognitive modules. For years, what they were doing was giving this list of cognitive modules, everything from perceptual mechanisms to number counting to mate guarding, but just a hodgepodge. Well, what has emerged in the late 90s and the last decade is human life history theory as the central conceptual organizing principle in evolutionary social science. And what that gives us is structure. It gives us the sense of the reproductive cycle, which is a principle that applies to all organisms, as a differentiated sequence for any given species, consisting in the mode of birth and the development, growth and development, the forms of social interaction, the forms of reproduction, length of life. You know, there's all of that differs from species to species, and the way it differs is the central way in which the characteristics of that species are organized into a coherent, causal, systemic whole. And the human life history is particularly interesting, and in all sorts of ways, and it's linked to those of the chimpanzees and the other primates. But it's got all kinds of unique features that they have a lot of rich explanatory power. That's what I was interested in. John is most, as his talk just indicated to you, is my impression is most powerfully animated by reason number four. To generate new empirical knowledge, but we share interest in both and came together on those purposes. So reason number one, to demonstrate that major components of literary meaning can be reduced to the elements of human nature derived from evolutionary psychology. A couple of the responses I got to the Target article, sometimes from the same person. One, human nature is infinitely mysterious and complex and can never be reduced to a set of elements. And two, that the elements of human nature are so well known that they scarcely bear mentioning. It's mundane and uninteresting even to talk about them. Well, what we decided to do here then was put it into action, operationalize it. We started with motives. Motives are life goals, end purposes. It's pretty basic. They can always be reduced in ultimate terms to, so survival and reproduction is survival only in the service of reproduction, but you can also break it down into other elements. So we took 12 and starting with survival, routine work, mating, wealth, power, helping non-kin, making friends, factor analyzed the whole thing and came up with five motive factors. Dominance turned out to be the factor that had the most explain the most variance, and that's antagonistic. No, that's overwhelmingly the characteristic of antagonists. They're seeking dominance, wealth, power, and prestige with a negative correlation on helping non-kin. Constructive effort is the protagonistic motive, and it consists of two elements. One element is pro-social or altruistic, helping non-kin and making friends. The other element is cultural. Seeking education, building or creating something. It's only very recently the evolutionary psychology has started to come up to speed on the importance of culture. But we knew from the beginning that culture is terribly important. It's important in these novels, and it's a major motive factor for a lot of the characters. So that's the other elements, the romance, subsistence, and nurture are distributed among the protagonists. As you'll see in the next slide, the scores are standardized, which means that the midline here is the zero point. It's the average of score of all the characters across all 441 characters. So if you go above that line, now these are units of standard deviation. If you go above that line, you're above average. You go below it, you're below average. So male protagonists, for instance, score highest on constructive effort. Female protagonists score nearly as high, and they score high also on romance and on nurture. That reflects the socio-economic reality of the times. Women didn't have careers. The women in these novels were educated. They were interested in constructive effort. But then they found a mate and devoted themselves to family. The men, the male protagonists, are interested in subsistence. That means they have to go out and get a job, too. And the protagonists, as you can see, are interested exclusively in dominance. That's all they care about. They're virtually...
The antagonist.
Interested exclusively in wealth, power, and prestige for its own sake. So we broke down mate selection. We picked three criteria of selecting mates that are known from evolutionary psychology to be preferentially held by females, power, prestige, and wealth, physical attractiveness preferentially held by males, and three in the middle that are sex-neutral criteria, just desirable things to have in a mate, reliability, kindness, and prestige. There are a few factor analyses I've ever seen in personality psychology or other places that break down that neatly. That was very satisfying, and it's almost identical for both short and long-term mating. Here are the results. The male protagonists are interested overwhelmingly in physical beauty. That was interesting, and it's not something you would necessarily have expected. You might think, well, these are Victorian male protagonists. They'll overlook, you know, mere physical beauty, you know, the skin deep. They're only interested in the soul. And no, they're not. You know, they're really not. You sometimes hear that, you know, the Victorian novel is prudish. That's really not true. I mean, the Victorian novel is supercharged with sexual feeling. It's not pornographic. You know, it's not literal. You don't see people groping in elevators. But it's charged with sexual feeling, and, you know, there's the proof. I mean, there's the reality of it right there. Female protagonists, because they're female, they're interested in extrinsic qualities. They're looking for wealth, power, and prestige in a mate. You know, Elizabeth is not going to marry a guy who doesn't have enough money, you know, to support her. She ends up marrying a guy who has an estate. But they're also interested in intrinsic qualities, in the inner qualities, you know, in reliability and kindness and intelligence. You get over to male antagonists, and this was interesting. You wouldn't really have expected this either. Male antagonists aren't interested in anything. I mean, they don't care. They're too busy as a. This is not a Victorian novel, but in Catch 22, Colonel Cathcart at one point is offered an opportunity to spend the night with beautiful women, and he was not going to waste his time if it wasn't going to be to his benefit in some way. You know, he's there after wealth, power, and prestige. The female antagonists are interested only in the extrinsic qualities in a mate. Okay, personality factors, the other ones we made up. The five-factor personality system was ready-made for us. That's the standard now in personality psychology. Extroversion, agreeableness, conscientiousness, emotional stability, and openness to experience, which is sort of a cultural characteristic, cultural curiosity. The male and female protagonists are pretty similar. They're introverted, you know, mild, meek, and quiet. They're agreeable, conscientious, stable, and open. As you can see, the females are just a little better at all of that than the males. And one of the things that we found pervasively in the novels is that there's what we call the gynocentric norm. It's female-centered. It's the female protagonists are in various, in almost every way, the central normative group for the characters. And again, we didn't know that really before we started. The antagonists, as you can see again, they're extroverted. And here, extroversion evidently serves as a proxy for aggressiveness or assertiveness. But they're disagreeable, unconscientious, emotionally unstable, and narrow-minded. So there's no equivocation in all of that. The emotional responses, and again, these are not responses in the characters, they're responses of the readers to the characters. We started with Ekman's seven basic emotions and modified it a little bit for our own purposes. Dislike was by far the largest factor, accounting for most of the variance. All the negative emotions, anger, disgust, contempt, and fear, load on that with negative correlations on admiration and liking. Now, clearly the antagonists score very high on that, the protagonists score very low. Sorrow, the tragic emotions, you know, Aristotle's fear and pity, fear for the character and sadness with a negative correlation on amusement. And then interest, that we just threw in, made it up, as it were, on the term indifference, and that's what it loads most heavily on, negative correlation on indifference. We threw it in as an affectively neutral measure of emotional absorption, and it ended up being one of our richest categories in ways that we really didn't expect at all. One of the advantages of doing this kind of work is you just come up with things. I mean, you have an idea, you have to have a purpose, you have to have a hypothesis you're going to test, but you come up with all kinds of things you don't even expect, you know, just riches. And so the emotional responses. This was very interesting. You know, as we expected, the male protagonists score low on dislike, relatively high on sorrow, but they're not interesting. They're not interesting precisely because they're not dominant. It's part of coalitional psychology. They're key players. And the coalitional psychology is centrally involved with suppressing dominance. And if you're going to be undominant enough, you're going to be kind of dull. And the female protagonists are more interesting, and we have the speculations for why that might be. You know, they're after mates, they're the question of suppressing their natural male aggressiveness it doesn't really come up. And the antagonists, as you can see, that's a a robust, you know, indication of dislike. And the more interesting, though, than the male protagonist, and no sorrow. I mean, they almost always end up in the Victorian novel, you know, getting shafted in the end. But nobody cries over a dead antagonist, right? You know, they get what's coming to them, and everybody's glad. Okay, reason two, to test empirically the contention that agonistic structure reflects an egalitarian ethos central to human evolutionary history. David mentioned this yesterday. I think this is probably the most important book in human evolutionary social theory over the past 10, 15 years or so. It's really a very simple hypothesis, the idea that humans, like chimpanzees, have dominance hierarchies, but they also have an extra layer of evolved social adaptations, heavily dependent on their capacity for symbolic communication, heavily dependent also, as David's illustration indicated, on their missile-throwing capacity to be able to eliminate dominant individuals from a safe distance. So what hunter-gatherers do is to create an egalitarian society by systematically, pervasively suppressing dominance in individuals. And our thesis was that what would happen in these novels, our hypothesis, was that the structure of agonistic relations would exactly mirror the kind of egalitarian, dominance-suppressing dynamic that we see in hunter-gatherer culture, which is in fact what we found. Just very quickly, historically, the course of human evolutionary social theory over the past 20 or 30 years has been there's a paradigm change that's taken place. We're not at the end of it, but we're certainly at the end of the beginning of the paradigm change that is moving away from simple direct reciprocation as the only form of glue to hold social groups together, to this whole range of thinking that recognizes finally the salience, the central importance of evolved social adaptations for pro-social, altruistic behavior in humans. And Bohm's theory is the background for that. It's within that kind of egalitarian, dominant-suppressing social dynamic that humans create, the kind of social environment in which it's possible for pro-social, altruistic dispositions to evolve. And as most of you probably know, David has been the hero of this story, really. Starting out something of a gadfly, regarded as something of a gadfly at HBES decades ago, persisting and ultimately triumphing. Sounds like a Victorian novel, really, you know. Reason three, to bring empirical evidence to bear on a major theoretical controversy, the adaptive function of literature. What we thought we could do would be to draw inferences about the adaptive function by working backwards from the observations of actual effects. We could say, well, what does literature actually do, you know, right now, at this time? And what kind of, you know, actual psychological and social functions do the novels fulfill? And then can we draw plausible connections between what happens currently and what might have happened within the EEA? We think we can. I'll come back to that in a little bit. Reason four, to generate empirical findings about the novel as a whole, about particular novels and novelists. John kept goading me all through this process for years now. He's been sort of sending me emails saying, well, come on with something. What have we found? We've got to have definite empirical findings. So every time he did that, I'd write some down. And what I ended up with was a list of 35 items. This is John's original title for his book, Narrowing Possibility Space. You know, you narrow down the range of possible explanation by having definite findings. And we came up with 35 topics on which we produced specific findings. I'll just skim through them. Hit the ones in red are just the ones I'll mention. The existence and function of agonistic structure. It's the kind of thing on which, you know, you could just argue all day long. Does it exist? I mean, yes it does, no it doesn't. I mean, you can come up with, it's the kind of thing people love to do in literary study. You know, you can just see them sitting in a seminar, you just pose it, put that on the table, you know, and say, my students, does agonistic structure exist? And you just kind of sit back and relax, and somebody bullshits for a while on one side, somebody bullshits for a while on the other side, And they come to no conclusion, and they feel at the end that they've had a good time, and they fulfilled, you know, the function of the humanities, which is to discourse, you know, to discourse widely, and to exercise their rhetorical talents. Well, we tested it, and we can tell you definitively that agonistic structure does in fact exist, that we came up with very rich, robust, precise correlations among all the elements of this design. So what's the relation of agonistic structure to the evolved political dispositions of human nature? It actually reflects them. It is a medium through which they're realized. The essentially positive character, the male-female relations in the novels, this is something that we didn't really anticipate, but it's one of the, and historically, within literary studies, it's one of the most important findings that we came up with. Male-female relations in the novel are essentially complementary. They're positive. The male and female protagonists form coalitions to resist the predatory threats of antagonists. The differences between male and female characters are often quite small, and the evaluative differences are neutral. The issue of dislike, our readers do not dislike or like males or females more. Root for, you know, do you want this character to succeed? Our readers do not root for males or females more. There is no polarity between males and females. There are differences, but there's no evaluative polarity between males and females. Instead, there's an evaluative polarity between the dominant-seeking antagonist, both male and female, and the protagonist. The relatively low level of interest in male protagonists, I already mentioned that, that's just simply part and parcel of the coalitional psychology. The affiliative and culturally active character protagonist, again, that's something that evolutionary psychology has only very recently begun to come to grips with. They needed to get multi-level selection before they could begin to develop an adequate theory of culture. And, you know, this question keeps coming out, well, what can literary people offer scientists? Well, we can tell them that you can ignore culture all day long, but if you do, you're going to be missing one of the most important aspects of the data in the Victorian novel, because these people care. I mean, it's a motive for them. It's an elemental basic motive. The isolation of dominance behavior with antagonistic characters. Ask yourself, is it really the case? I mean, is it a plausible representation of reality as we know it, that the world is divided into two very distinct kinds of groups of people? One group of people is animated exclusively, overwhelmingly, by the desire for wealth, power, and prestige. And those people are also older and uglier, and they're narrow-minded, and they have all kinds of nasty personality traits, and they're not very smart, but they're in positions of power. And the other group of people consists of young, attractive, mild, moderate, pro-social people, who are threatened and challenged by these trolls, the antagonists, and that these two sets of people regularly and consistently come into a sharp and definitive clash over their interest, and that the result of that clash is almost invariably that the young and attractive people triumph. If that is your vision of the world, then you will answer yes to the question, does the Victorian novel give you an accurate, mimetically accurate representation of reality? And if your answer to that is no, you'll have to ask yourself, you know, why is it then that the Victorian novel represents social dynamics in precisely the way that it does? The assimilation of amoral male sexual preferences to the normal value structure of the novels, I think that's interesting. I think it's interesting that within the normative value structure of these novels, the male desire for physical beauty is not a bad thing at all. I mean, it's part of the romance, it's part of the glamour, it's part of the fun and vitality of the world that they inhabit. The essentially non-agonistic character of male-female relations in the novel, I already mentioned that. The influence of authorial sex on the ideology of gender. We tested this. We ran statistical tests comparing the depiction of males and females in all the different character sets by male and female authors. And what we found is a qualification of the thesis that the relations among the sexes are essentially non-agonistic, because we found that there are real differences, and the difference is that the female protagonists by female authors score much higher on constructive effort. They are discontented with the purely domestic sphere in which they are localized in the novels. There is an undercurrent of unrest and the kind of drive towards a transformation in the social roles of women that has persisted to the present day and that we see the results of all around us at the present time. The feminization of protagonistic males in Austen's novels. We're getting close to the end here. Everybody always says, well, tell us something particular. And so you tell them something particular, and they say, well, that's too particular. But so we tried to do everything, you know. We gave a lot of particular detail. We found things about Austen that we really didn't know. I've been teaching Austen for, you know, 3 decades. And it had never, while sort of immersing myself impressionistically in the imaginative atmosphere of her novels, I had never analytically recognized that part of an essential, crucial feature of the ethos, the atmosphere that she creates, is that her males are systematically feminized in their mate selection characteristics. They're looking not for physical beauty. And this is, you know, her scores, the scores of her characters, compared to that of the total data set, which includes, you know, everybody from the Brontes through E.M. Forster. They don't care for physical beauty. They care very much for the intrinsic qualities, and they're very nurturing. It's a domestic, feminized world. It's also a world in which the negative emotions of sorrow are almost banished, so that you get a light, bright, sparkling, domestic, feminine world, which is one of the main reasons that Austen has become a kind of a central therapeutic recuperation center for British soldiers suffering from post-traumatic stress syndrome. Kipling has a story called The Jainites, right? As a battery battalion in the First World War, in which the whole battery of, you know, like 12 people formed the Jane Austen Club. And the common soldiers and the officers, they sit around discussing her novels and, you know, talking about whether Elizabeth really should have done that, or whether Darcy, you know, wasn't Darcy rude at the opening of that? And then at the end of the story, they're all blown to hell, body parts everywhere. You know, they get land right on the top of them. But it's an odd thing. I mean, it keeps coming up in all kinds of weird contexts. So the basic elements of human social interaction that have been isolated and overgeneralized in the 3 models of tragedy used to interpret the Mayor of Canterbury. Again, that's very particular. We picked one novel, went back and read everything that had been written on it, and it's a tragic novel, and virtually all of the interpretive efforts have been efforts to define the tragedy. It's a puzzle. It annoys people. It irritates people because they can't get their handle on it. There have been 3 models that have been used over and over again in kind of recurrent cycles of interpretation. Retributive justice, you know, the gods are punishing people who do the wrong thing. Regenerative transformation, you know, sort of a moral uplift at the end. Promethean heroism, defying the gods. And all of them are wrong, and that's exactly why they have continued to cycle. You know, you come up with one idea, it doesn't satisfy you, you come up with the other idea, you find variations on it. We found out why it was wrong. All of those models presuppose a kind of an emotional absorption that's essential to tragedy, you know, being involved in the pathos. And that little category of indifference that we turned out to be the emotional response factor interest, we found all the characters in this novel score much, much lower on that than the characters, than the average of the characters. And what we infer from that is that Hardy is not actually interested in the ordinary kind of tragic pathos. What that novel does for him is to serve as a medium for stoic detachment. It's a kind of coping mechanism. And it's very difficult for people to get a handle on interpretively, even though, you know, for the Hardy stuff, we contacted Hardy specialists. We got like 85 responses from Hardy specialists. Even though their own emotional responses were revealing that their own emotional relationship to the story was out of sync with the kind of interpretive models they were using. So the one most important finding, again, that agonistic structure mirrors the basic political dynamic in egalitarian hunter-gatherer cultures. It's important, I think, that it's an empirical finding. It's not something we just made up. Something we can demonstrate quantitatively. From that empirical finding, we can draw an inference of large-scale theoretical significance. The novel served as a medium for readers to participate in an egalitarian social ethos. They help create the ethos that governs the society of its readers. It enables people. Why do they do it? It enables them to cooperate as a social unit. Modern readers of the novels, us, participate vicariously in the same ethos. We think that you can reason from the current psychological function of the novels to the function that fictions might have served in ancestral environments. You know, the egalitarian political dynamic uncovered by Bohm suggests that what the novels actually are prosthetic extensions of cultural practices that in oral cultures require face-to-face interaction. And so for us, that's important. The adaptive function of literature is centrally important to our understanding of an evolved human nature. Here are two recent books that talk about the emergence of fully modern humans 50,000 years ago, about the same time that people began to leave Africa. So thank you.
Cut that off, but we've used pretty much all the question time, so I'm going to take one question, but I'm going to let you choose who it is. One hand up.
Go.
I think I just want to say that the approach that you and Brian and John are pioneering, I think, is fantastic.
Okay.
The way that you guys sort of framed yourselves to us is as literary studies researchers who are using evolution. I was grounded in saying that you're actually evolutionists who are using literary data, and that this is an important distinction to make in relation to the problem that this conference is supposed to have. And basically, the sort of next step from that would be that the disciplines that we've been identifying here in the humanity.
They're
data sets, not disciplines. Basically, if we think about literary studies, archaeology, the discipline that I'm in, classics, cultural anthropology. The thing that's most salient about them is the data set. There's multiple theories, and typically a single data set. Contrast that with evolutionary biology, we get one theoretical framework, multiple lines of data that are being employed, and you're basically adding on an additional line of data here, the flaw of the evolutionary theory. And so I would suggest the challenge then for us is to think about not how to achieve vertical integration or whatever you want to call it, consilience, consistency. That's going on. I mean, we can see it in your work. It's happening. The question is, the issue, I think, is how to persuade university authorities to rearrange the universities so the natural connections that come through this use of evolutionary theory actually become able to be sort of exploited
there's several issues there, two particularly. Start with the first one. Is what we're doing using literary as a data set? John's often said that that's one of the things he's doing, and he said, you know, there's this rich source of data there when he's talking to social scientists, and that's certainly part of what we're doing. I mean, once you're doing consilience, those questions of, you know, which discipline you're in or, you know, how you're using the data, I mean, they cease to be kind of permanent walls. They simply become permeable partitions. You can just move them around however you like. It's some of the kind of things that John has done with folk tales, I would regard as essentially social science. And I mean, they address questions that are relevant to literary scholars, and certainly should have an impact on the kind of theories that literary scholars use. But they've been published in social science journals. And if you say that we're going to define literary study as a kind of study that casts illumination, particularly on specific literary texts, they don't do that, and they're not designed to do that. What they're designed to do is to use quasi-literary text as data sets to test propositions about the universality of depicted aspects of human nature. What we've done here, actually, is to try to combine some kind of large-scale, you know, theoretical issue, using it as a data set, and we are doing that. I mean, our main conclusion is a conclusion in evolutionary biology, basically, that's what these texts are representations that they're designed to fulfill a certain kind of socio-political, socio-psychological function. However, we are also interested in doing interpretive literary study. Brian's book is about half the book consists of case studies. Every now and again, I play hooky from this kind of thing and go off and write an interpretive essay on Wuthering Heights or Dorian Gray or something. And in this study itself, we tried to combine both. We have, as I said, a whole chapter on Jane Austen, in which we're not just kind of doing bulleted points. Those are the interpretive conclusions we've come to. But we have readings of the novels and commentaries on the whole imaginative structure of our universe. And then in The Mayor of Casterbridge, we in fact have a whole chapter which is a detailed consideration of using the data, but a detailed consideration of all the relations among the characters, the tonal structure of the novel, the correlation between the tonal structure and the formal structure. What we're trying to do is give a complete sort of carpet bombing approach to that, that particular novel.
We weren't supposed to be
My sense of it is that it forms a continuum. This is one of the issues that kept coming up in the responses to this Target article was, aren't you doing social science, and what does this have really to do with literary study? And I quoted a passage from Evolution in Literary Theory 15 years ago where I said that I envision a continuum in which I would certainly do what John was saying. I would require all graduate students in literature to begin with a course in statistics and another course in empirical methods. But I wouldn't think that all of them are going to end up being basically social scientists. I would think that they would become much more sensitive to the ethos that governs the use of evidence, and that they would be much more capable of assimilating information from the sciences, but that a lot of them would end up doing largely historical, interpretive, discursive work of a more responsible character, I think, than is now done, but still recognizably within the kind of traditional frame of interpretive literary criticism. And again, I still do that kind of thing, too. And I don't consider myself simply sort of grandfathering myself out, because that's where I got my training. I think it's a continuum. I think there's a methodological continuum. One of the people writing a response said, "Will there still be room for the kind of interpretive work that reveals the richness and depth of a critical mind, of an interpretive critical mind?" And I said, "Yes, absolutely. There will have to be." And I'm kind of turned John's own theory against him. I said, if you take John in his most sort of militantly empirical moods, you'll say that, that kind of thing is merely an idle pastime, for the entertainment of a leisured class, but that it doesn't count as intellectual work. It really has no place in the universe. It's not research. And I said, let's just take that. Whether John ever said that or not, let's stick him with it for convenient polemical purposes and say that, John's own book on Homer that he just published is a rich refutation of, as he himself will say, is a rich refutation of that position, because it's anthropological, it's sociobiological, it uses game theory, but it is a rich and vivid evocation of the imaginative universe of Homer. And there will always be room for that.
Thank you very much.